I'm Britta Wigginton.
I'm Brett Scholes.
And I'm Maddie Gibson.
We're a group of early career researchers.
And we're all from the International Society of Critical Health Psychology,
otherwise known as ISCHIP.
And you're listening to The Operative Word.
Hi, you're listening to Volume 1, Issue 4 of The Operative Word, the official podcast of the International Society of Critical Health Psychology, which we sometimes refer to as ISCHIP. I'm Ali Gibson, a lecturer at Victoria University of Wellington, Aotearoa, New Zealand. I co-edit this podcast with my colleagues, Dr. Brett Scholes, a research fellow at the Australian National University, and Dr. Britta Wigginton, who's a lecturer at the University of Queensland in Australia. In this issue, we'll be talking to Dr. Glenn Yankovsky. Glenn's a senior lecturer in critical and social psychology at Leeds Beckett University in the UK. Before we get into a discussion with him, let's first hear Glenn giving his 5-minute challenge presented at the 2017 ISCHIP conference.
Of course, reciting a poem makes me balk, by reason it's no less constructed than an academic talk. Maybe it's hypocrisy to call the conference out when I'm on the committee and white with that pout. For sure there is high risk that me, you, Jesus, will mortify, but I have somehow determined to give it a try. Real quotes are used, it rhymes, you may have guessed. It's pretty empirical too, references available upon request. An honour of which I am sensible, to the eugenics guy, did BPS President Francis Abeling in this letter reply. But that's him, not me. I'm not of late, I'm not old, and I'm certainly not straight. And so I plan to shame Francis Abeling. Convenient to paint him as not me, as raving. As a historical racist, wanting to sterilise black people disabled and others he despised. Of course he was wrong, abhorrent is this letter. I'm just no longer sure that I am much better. Because of psych we're critical, that health is more than physical, but racism ain't factored, we're rarely even quizzical. Racism is that he looks like the defendant, said James Botsin's lawyers. She's against the police. It's the way they remove black jurors. It's if you're cocaine caught, then you're arrested if black. And it's that few of us fought, powder lets you off more than crack. It's that black Americans form, of the country 13%, but of prisoners it's almost 40, and this we don't lament. It's still segregated schools, with few teachers or resource packs, because unlike the whites, your school's funding lacks. It's that to buy your own home outside of segregated red zones that Wells Fargo's sell mud people risky ghetto loans. It's that whites with a criminal record are employed before you if you're black, and that your degree returns 5,000, but for whites it's 10 times that. Yes, blind racism are we. Somehow it escapes our sight that our participants are almost always white. That we said black people were dumb or handed out sentences with no release to those we deemed schizophrenics for paranoia against the police. It's that most can't afford trials, so plea for a petty crime. Really what matter is health when that's how so many black boys spend their time. What has racism got to do with health? It's access to healthcare. It's stress wearing down the body. It's health being anything but fair. It's less anaesthetic, because black people don't feel pain. It's being attacked on the street, because immigrants are to blame. It's police that kill you. It's low or no pay. It's poor housing, polluted cities. It's these that ebb health away. I'm awed by racism's breadth, of my ignorance ashamed, shocked about its depth, and that so often it goes unnamed. I think we need to accept that racism means little wealth, and that both class and race are intimately related to health. Okay, that's fine, but what's to be done? I don't have all the answers, but I may have some. Let's teach beyond the West, avoid only white keynotes, and through our sweet society, let's BME work promote. For names and teaching resources, use this BME psychology. Finally, for any mortification, please accept my apology. Thank you.
As an audience, it came as a big surprise that Glenn decided to present his 5-minute challenge as a poem, but I'll hand over to Brett to kick things off.
So we have all listened to your recording, and By the way, it's amazing. Listening to it again just reaffirmed how brilliant it was and how creative you were, and it was wonderful.
That's incredibly generous of you. I think you've learned the trick of hosting a podcast is flatter your guests to hell and then they will be putty in your hands. So well acted. Thank you.
No, yeah. It's not acted, Glenn. Honestly, it's such an important message. So I'm really excited to be talking about it today.
Yeah, thanks. That was what sustained me, so I could get behind the message, the format. I am still so deeply unconfident with, but I thought the message was worthwhile.
So if you want to just jump right in, and first of all to say thank you so much for coming on today and talking to us, especially given the length of time since the 5MC. And I also wanted to say well done on actually upping the game and going and reconstructing the 5-minute challenge into a poem. I thought that was and I know I personally found it really compelling, and talking to other people in the audience how much they appreciated your message. But I wondered for you, you know, what prompted you, what inspired you to decide to call psychology out on its historical roots in racism and bring a critical lens to the topic?
Well, thanks for having me and for doing the podcast. It's lovely to be on it. It's a good question. I think one of the key things, you know, obviously it was a poem, but it was also slides. And so I was very glad that we could show images. And so the key thing I was trying to show, I was content analysing our British Psychological Society presidents, what their likely ethnicity and gender would be. And I think 4 out of the first 10 were legitimate paid up members of the Eugenics Society and proud members. And it wasn't a history I was aware of. And, you know, I think because we have psychology has such obvious links to explicit racism like eugenics. And it surprises me and disappoints me today, even in myself, how little we try and redress that.
And you spoke about, in particular, different structures and practices that still take place in society today, with jury selection, with justice system, unequal sentencing, for example, with drug use, which I found particularly interesting, and essentially how racism continues to structure so many practices within society.
Yeah.
I wonder, what do you think our role is as critical health psychologists to address this or call attention to practices?
Yeah, that's, I'm continually, I think I tried to say this as well, a bit dumbfounded at how deep and broad racism is, I think, because it's in so many different institutions, from education to our curriculum, to schools at an early age. Like in the US today, there's still legal segregation where it's not black and white, but it's poor and middle class, and the people who tend to be poorer are black children. It's so deep and broad and just surprising to me. And then, you know, as critical health psychologists, health is such a structurally determined thing, isn't it? It's, you know, of course we're impacted by all these systems. So critical health researchers are trying to draw attention to these systems and cultures that make people unhealthy and keep people ill and, you know, suffering in some ways, and yet we don't really attend to this very broad, explicit, violent structural system that disadvantages black minority ethnic people or minoritized ethnic people.
Throughout his 5-minute presentation, Glenn refers to the term BME, psychology, BME people. By this, he's referring to black minoritized ethnic people.
You know, I think our job is to draw attention to that and to challenge it. And of course, I think it's important to emphasize, is to align with the current movements led by the people affected, like Black Lives Matter, you know.
So Glenn, I'm really interested, this idea of like allyship to particular minority groups is something that I'm so interested in and has actually kind of been a bit of a theme that I've kind of been pulling out of a few podcast episodes. I wonder if you could talk about what it means to, because I know I've read some of your work as well, including recently in, I think it was called The Psychologist, how you coded the ethnicity, nationality, and gender of authors of your anthropology texts and readings. I'm just curious about what it means to not be Black or minority ethnic and doing this work, how that works, what that means, if you could comment a little bit more on that.
Yes, really good question. So that project is run by some colleagues and I at Leeds Beckett University, and we're very mindful, or we try to be very mindful of the fact that we're majority white on that project. I'm white, and I believe in standpoint theory. I agree with standpoint theory that if you are a member of a certain oppressed group, you have an expertise on that. Those who aren't members of that group have to do a lot of learning and listening and respectful engagement in order to be conscious of that oppression. So I think it's something we grapple with, and you need to be sensitive with and respectful. The idea that doing nothing is not acceptable, and putting the labour of undoing structural racism onto those affected is unacceptable too. To be honest, you know, even in myself, I will hold this critique, but among colleagues as well, we are not talking about this structural issues like racism. We're not grappling with allyship and can I do something, can I not? We're just ignoring it, majority. Mm. So I know we need to get away from that default position.
Yeah, I think as researchers, any issue of race or racism or working with a minority group so often gets brushed aside as, oh, that's logistically too difficult, or I don't know about those issues, or I'm not part of the community. And I think those are just too easy excuses, and that we actually do need to try harder to grapple with these issues.
And I wonder, Glenn, because you mentioned standpoint theory, which is really useful as a kind of framework for working as an ally with minoritized groups. Is there other methodologies or theories that you found useful in your work in this space?
Yeah, I need to read more about this, but it's definitely on my periphery and I know it's really fundamental. Critical race theory. And from my understanding, this is that racism is embedded institutionally. It can be covert or overt. It's intersectional and it needs structural dismantling. And I think that's really, really important. And then for me, actually, Nancy Fraser's work on redistribution and recognition, which I think is so relevant today. She is a Marxist feminist. And what she shows is that in order to achieve justice, which I think a lot of critical psychologists want to do in some way, we have to look at how equality is distributed between groups materially in terms of the income, the housing, any kind of material resources, but also the politics of recognition and which groups are represented, how are they represented. And she says that both elements are essential for justice and one can't overtake the other. And I think that's really important, especially with the underrepresentation of Black minoritized ethnic people in psychology. Of course, there is an issue of recognition. Are we recognizing the work of BME colleagues? Are we appreciating it for what it's telling us? That's absolutely an issue. But of course, BME people to get into the discipline of psychology have to have some kind of basic wealth, access to education, all these material resources that, you know, are barriers.
Glenn, you keep mentioning the term BME. I wonder if you could unpack that a bit for listeners who might not be familiar with it.
Sure. So it's a term that our race equality forum uses at Leeds Beckett, which I find really useful. So typically it's known as Black minority ethnic. So that's, you know, people disadvantaged by racism, but actually the term that they use, which I think is even better, is Black minoritized ethnic, as in a process of minoritization has happened to them.
Which I think leads really well into a question that I had. I was looking through your website, bmepsychology.com, and you and your colleagues talk about the Western non-Western divide. And I think in research, teaching, running conferences, very often we do orient to this binary. And I wonder if you could
talk a bit about how that's problematic and also how we can avoid reinstating whiteness or Western culture as the norm to be compared against. And I think minoritization probably comes into that.
Yeah, great question. So our course at Leeds Beckett, and this was other colleagues that weren't me, they teach this and they do really well on this, I think. They teach, one of the assignments in the first year, first semester, is to get our students to read a paper by Jeffrey Arnett in 2008 called Neglected 95%. And he empirically showed, in a method that I think is useful because so many people listen to numbers and statistics still, that, you know, the majority of samples in psychology, in top psychological journals, were Western. And the editors were Western, the authors tend to be Western as well. And so he referred to the rest of the population, 95%, or rest of non-America, basically, North America, non-North America, as the neglected 95%. So of course, when we talk about Western, I know it's a proxy and it's not a perfect proxy. And I know Brett has had some good sort of critiques of this. It's trying to look at the bias towards those countries that have a particular leg up in terms of the lingua franca, so that people are English native speakers, have a lot of resources, global dominance, etc. And that's North America, Canada, Australasia, some of that, and then some parts of Europe, but not Eastern Europe, etc. So it's trying to identify that bias, despite there being some countries within the West, some countries outside of the global North that are still part of that.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious about how your work in this area and other people's work in this area has affected mainstream psychology. So are they, mainstream psychologists, listening? Has it had an impact? Have you observed a change?
Oh, great. We are trying to engage with mainstream psychologists in a mature way, which I haven't always done in the past, recognizing that, you know, many psychologists, even mainstream psychologists, have great intentions, are doing good work, etc. And also trying to avoid the tendency that, you know, to include work by a BME author is all that's needed to be done, to avoid any essentializations about BME people as inherently different and their work being inherently different to white people. So we're trying to strike that balance with the website that we set up and the psychologist letters, whilst identifying that this problem is structural and, you know, racism. I know lots of people don't like that word, but it, you know, it's connected to that. So we've had small, quiet, stilting success, I think. It's definitely a work in progress.
I'm interested in just building off Brett's question around kind of the beginnings of impact in terms of your website. From a teaching perspective, I saw that you had really great resources that are available to be used in the classroom. You have a, you know, structured assessment around assessing students' understanding and kind of demonstrating their knowledge around the content that you've created. Can you talk a little bit about that and how, say, people from around the world, ISCHIP listeners, could take up your content and integrate it into the classroom?
Yeah, thank you. So we were painfully aware, speaking from a place of white privilege, of course, so the pain is very minimal, how big the task of undoing this problem is. It's gigantic. And so our efforts alone would be so minimal. So what we try to do with the website is allow anyone to contribute. And especially, you know, if BME psychologists are doing fantastic work currently, and they are, and there's a lot more work than I knew about before I started this project that really humbled me in thinking, you know, why haven't I attended to this before? So we wanted to provide a small signpost repository to that work that anyone can contribute to. We're aware as well, you know, I'm a lecturer myself, that people are busy, lots of priorities, and, you know, having ready-made teaching materials could be useful. So far, it's only my teaching materials that are online. They're a little bit imperfect. I tend to throw stuff on a lecture slide and then maybe it comes together. So we are desperate for contributions from other people, and, you know, you can credit it however you like. And yeah, any ISCHIP members who have teaching resources on anti-racism or from a more global perspective, that would be fantastic. Or just names, references that they can point to along those lines, that'd be great. We've set up a Google document that anyone can contribute to, so it's really interactive, and then of course they can email me or the project team. So we're hoping people do add to it.
And I was going to say, Glenn, on a personal note, in terms of unpacking racialized teaching content, the way in which this kind of came to the fore for I work in public health was through an Indigenous integration project where we were, as a school, required to integrate Indigenous content into all courses. So it wasn't tokenistic in terms of knowledge or perspectives, but it was systematically integrated and content was rethought in light of Indigenous perspectives and knowledges. So I see what you're doing is so important, particularly for academics who are time poor and wanting to up the ante of their, in terms of their teaching content, in terms of pushing students, pushing knowledge, and actually teaching in a way that's just and fair in terms of representing perspective. So I love what you've done there. I wonder if there's ways that you can begin to track the impact of that. I mean, do you have, you can track downloads in terms of your resources, but how do you, you know, orienting to Brett's question, how do you possibly track the impact of what you're doing so as to, I guess, give credit to what it might be, kind of the trickle-on effects in terms of uptake?
Yeah, thank you. So we got a small amount of funding for 1 year, and impact is a requirement for that. So we've had to do that, and obviously as researchers, you know, that's in our makeup in some ways. I think the quant content analysis we did was a useful proxy to show this problem. We counted up how many authors were white, male, Western, and it's in no way perfect, it's just a useful proxy. And then we also did focus groups on our course with our BME students who wanted to participate. What impact was this having on you, this white Western curriculum, if any, you know? And of course it did. And so we thought the combination of research was useful, and I would definitely encourage other courses to uptake that method. The website does need more promotion. And I think the other thing we should flag up especially is that this is, of course, part of a wider movement led by staff and students at universities who are BME, the Why Is My Curriculum White movement. And so that change that those activists are bringing about, and often students are bringing about, I think we have to fit in and align with that and give credit to that, of course.
So just building on that, is that leading to change? And I guess this is a very slow, unfortunately, moving thing, but, you know, do you think that this is increasing leadership of BME individuals in psychology's upper echelons? And if so, or even if not, how can we, what can we do to help that to happen? I just mean critical health psychologists. I don't mean like we white people.
Yeah, all the four of us. I don't think it's leading to that change. I think in some ways, and it's a painful realization, this is, you know, the icing on the cake in some ways. Our curriculum and what we teach is important, and the recognition we have of other work by BME authors is necessary, but it's you know, structural racism, even in higher education, is embedded in so many different ways. The majority of BME members of our university, employed by our university, are cleaners or caterers on insecure contracts. These are redistributive issues. And to think of racism as just the curriculum, whiteness, is misguided and something we personally feel strongly about. I mean, even our British Psychological Society, it's never had a BME president, as far as I can tell. It's very androcentric too, despite majority women studying it at undergraduate level. So we do need change broader than that. One thing that's been useful in the UK, though, and that does give some hope, is the universities are very keen to, you know, have the best reputation possible. And so other activists have basically made universities apply for these marks of equality. And the one pertaining to this is called the Race Equality Charter Mark. My university is going for this. It has made a lot of institutional impetus for this specific project. And so I think if you can try and tie inequalities to the reputation of the university. I think that's a useful step to get broader change.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, and especially in affecting meaningful institutional change as opposed to this diversity or inclusivity rhetoric, which so often is just paying lip service and not actually affecting change.
I'm wondering, Glenn, if this is even, I'm wondering if this is even entrenched in, you know, the scientific method and ways in which we carry research and ethics applications and the assumptions that are imbued around, assumptions around what constitutes science and how we engage with our populations and what methods we use. It even, to me, infiltrates into all of that, our practices of research, our processes.
Yeah, I would totally agree. And you seem way more knowledgeable on that than I would be. And so please contribute to the website and share that, because it sounds very poignant and important.
Well, I'm just thinking about kind of positivism and this idea that the scientist is neutral, objective and detached. And that's very Western and white in terms of being in the lab coat and conducting objective research. So, and to me, that kind of infiltrates writing of ethics applications, like the most mundane practices of our research is viewed through that lens. So it, to me, it's a huge issue that kind of filters into all our research practices.
And you think about, as you say, if you're positioning yourself as neutral and just an observer, then it strips away any identity positions or, you know, race, class, sexuality, gender, whatever.
I think I was looking at the board of the Journal of Cross-Cultural Psychology, and it, of course, is mostly Western and white people. And there's a good critique about cross-cultural psychology being, you know, Western psychology exported into, inappropriately. And then I also personally think about, because in so much of my own learning and academic journey, I got so much from other alternative sources of knowledge, especially feminist academics, actually, feminist activists, Twitter pages, blogs, YouTube podcasts, you know, I'm sure like this one. And I guess it's that idea that only certain knowledges are valuable. And it's, I think that's such a dangerous one with the issue we're talking about, because we have, if you don't have a platform and as an oppressed group, then they don't have access to the knowledge platforms we have, and their expertise isn't seen. So I think we have to go broader.
Yeah, because if there are whole groups of people who simply don't even have access to higher education or peer-reviewed forums, then how could they possibly contribute to that knowledge production? And other forms of knowledge production are no less important, valid, useful.
And I liked your straightforward and immediate responses to this, Glenn, which was to teach beyond the West, avoid only white keynotes, and BME promote, kind of the tangible messages from your 5-minute challenge. That's kind of really nicely boiled down in terms of takeaway messages for a listener. Is there anything that you'd want to, you know, you have time beyond the 5 minutes now. Is there anything beyond those three that you'd want to chip in?
Well, oh, I'm glad you thought so. So I wanted to, academic habits are hard to break out of, right? So when you write a thing, you have to end it with some implications, and, you know, this was appropriate, and I'm glad that was the case. Also, I was constrained by rhyming, of course, but I think those ideas are still useful. I guess the other thing is, I'm trying to be particularly mindful of this, is there are BME academics talking about this. And so it would be, you know, be led by and follow behind and listen to, something I need to work on more. I have to say, we've got so much credit for this project. And I think it's, especially my university, you know, we are majority white. And I'm thinking, we've scraped the top of this issue. We haven't done that much. And so I'm kind of thinking about that a bit.
Reminds me of something that I often think about in my area. So I'm really interested in consumer leadership of the mental health services. And there's consumer academics who do so much, but because I'm privileged and I'm not a consumer and I, you know, come from the system, I get certain accolades, I guess, and certain, you know, people think it's amazing when I feel like, well, actually, there are so many people who are doing a lot more than I am. who aren't being recognized. But then at the same token, and I don't know if this is the same in terms of BME, that kind of area, but there's also just so few opportunities for consumer academics and so few of them that it's almost this problematic line that sometimes I wonder if I'm doing a good job or not, in that I try and advocate for consumer academics and inclusion, but at the same time, like, I don't want to lead it. But there's still not enough momentum yet for consumer academics to lead it. And so it's really tricky. And I don't know what my question is, or if I actually have a question, but just reflecting on traversing that line is really tough. And you want to do it in a way that's not tokenistic, but there's a part of me that wonders, am I doing it tokenistically? And I wonder if that applies in this area as well.
Yeah, I echo your hand wringing, and I think it's what we have to do. It's we, especially us in positions of privilege on this, hand wring and worry and are we getting it right, and asking are we getting it right, and listen when we're not. I think it's continuing that, and hopefully that's okay.
Yeah, and I think it's that case of, as you say, checking in with the group that you're working with and being open to criticism and then doing something about it.
Yeah.
Glenn, is there anything you'd like to add or an issue that you'd still like to talk about?
Just the worry that, you know, it's to how do we do justice to the topic and, you know, recognize the work that's been done. I don't know. I guess maybe I always think to Kenneth and Mamie Clark's work, and I don't understand why more people aren't enthralled by it, why they don't teach it on the first year intro to psych class. So they did a study on educational segregation. They gave dolls to Black kids. Half the Black kids were in segregated nurseries in the South. Half the kids were in integrated schools in the North. And what they did was they asked them a series of questions about the dolls, which one do you like better, which one's nice, which one looks like you. And it was a really clever, empirical form of conscientization, or however you pronounce that, in getting the kids to show what effect racial segregation was having on them. And then it was used in the Supreme Court in 1954 to legally end school segregation. And they dedicated their lives to these kind of issues. And innovative, it's a bit of qual, a bit of quant.
That's incredible. And maybe also before we wrap up, where do you see yourself going with this? Like, what are your next steps or hopes for the future?
Well, let's hope that there's more contributions to the website. And my course that I teach on and have a lot of influence over as a lecturer, you know, I hope that will be better on this in by next year. We're working on it, so I'll definitely update you.
Glenn, thank you so much. And I wonder, just to end off, if you could capture your incredible poem and this message in one word, what would the operative word of your 5-minute challenge be?
Condense my 5-minute challenge to one word. That was a curveball. That's a really tricky one. Is it just one word? Okay, my word is a hyphenated word. It's psychology's hyphen eugenic. Yeah, it's a critical interpretation of one word, Ali.
Glenn, that was phenomenal.
You're all so kind. Thank you so much for inviting me. So much fun. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this issue of The Operative Word, the official podcast of the International Society of Critical Health Psychology. We'd really like to continue this conversation with you. So if you have any comments, follow our Twitter account at CritHealthPsych and or use the hashtag TheOW, short for The Operative Word. Please don't forget to like and subscribe to the podcast and find any further information at the ISCHIP website. That's ischp.info. You can keep up with the editorial team on Twitter. Britta Wigginton is at Brit_Wig. Brett is Brett_Schultz. And I'm Ali F. Gibson.